Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Democrat John McCarron, Republican Mike Miller, and network talk show host Jim Bohannon. Our program tonight, coming from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications on State Street, that great street in Chicago. Thanks very much for being with us tonight. Our toll-free lines are now open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, our email address is btb@museum.tv. And if you'd like to join us on the World Wide Web, www.beyondthebeltway.com. And for the next 2 hours, we're going to talk about the election that just ended. We're not going to talk too much about the one that's coming up in 4 years. I promise you that. But this is going to be the night that wherever you're listening from coast to coast, you're going to have your opportunity to call in, offer your analysis, your two cents on what happened on election night. We're not going to do week after week about dissecting the election. Tonight's the big night. We will do that. But again, there is a bigger story, at least a bigger national story at this moment in time, and that is the resignation of the former head of the Central Intelligence Agency, General David Petraeus. That is still an unraveling story. He had to resign based on a admission that he had an extramarital affair. And let me begin with Jim Bohannon, who joins us, veteran talk show host, who was in town for the Radio Hall of Fame last night, a member of the Radio Hall of Fame. Jim, you do your show from Washington, so you have a lot of the D.C. insiders periodically on your program.
Indeed.
This has the potential to be a really big story.
Well, it certainly does. Obviously, Petraeus had been thought of as something, a pillar, I guess, of, well, just about everything, of intellect, of effectiveness, and above all, integrity. And so it does shake things a bit. I thought it was interesting to note that the president, I understand, was informed only Wednesday morning after the election.
How could it be, Mike Miller, a Republican from DePaul? The FBI began investigation of this story. They didn't know it led to Petraeus, but it's 2 months old. And yet no one within the FBI or its director ever communicated with the folks who are the head of the House and Senate, the Joint Committee on Intelligence, which by law they are supposed to do.
Right.
They never did it. Is the FBI, in your view, in serious shaky ground on this?
I certainly hope not, because they have a reputation to keep up, and people have to have confidence in the FBI that everything they do is above board. But when this kind of thing happens, it tends to shake people and wonder, are certain people treated differently than others? And that's unacceptable if that's the case.
John McCarron is our Democrat from DePaul University, longtime member of the Chicago Tribune editorial board. John, I know you are not a conspiracy theorist, but again, when news of this nature is delivered to the president at 5 o'clock on election day, I would suspect that even you are a little suspect of that.
Yeah, timing is everything in comedy, politics, and show business. And you know, I'm not into conspiracies, but you know, the incumbent has many powers, and one of them might be to, if there's going to be some very confusing, strange, bizarre thing to happen on the eve of the election, better it be him hugging a weary storm survivor in New Jersey than something like this. So maybe decisions were made at high levels to get this one past election night, as maybe a decision was made regarding shoot down of a drone over off Iran, which we didn't hear about until election night.
But Jim, what about, again, I don't know where you stand on the conspiracy level, but again, this who knew what, when, and how the news got to the White House is very curious.
Well, it is curious, and obviously
disappointing.
It is disappointing, and there are certainly oversight responsibilities that go to Congress, although there's been a tendency in recent years, I think, to kind of sweep those under the back burner. In this particular case, in terms of the timing with the election, it is hard to imagine just how this is somehow at all a partisan advantage for anyone. I doubt very seriously if anyone is suggesting that Joe Biden set him up with a date. I mean, there just doesn't seem to be anything other than...
But part of this is that Republicans generally like General Petraeus.
True.
So the question is, I mean, Eric Cantor somewhere in this timeline, the House Majority Leader, he was aware of it. But again, it's the FBI for 2 months investigating this. I can't believe that it did not go at least to the FBI director, which raises the question of when did Eric Holder, his boss, know about it?
I mean, but there's also the question of how much did they know 2 months ago, and did they know who it was going to lead to exactly when? So if they didn't know from the very beginning that this was going to connect all these people, I'm not so sure we should damn them and say that there's this conspiracy or a problem. It could be just
what about
that,
timing to you? I didn't ask you the timing question.
I certainly am disturbed by what's happening with Benghazi, that they kept pushing that underneath the rug, and that's a timing issue. And the Iranian drone shoot down was certainly an issue. And it happened even in Illinois. Of course, now we're learning that Jesse Jackson Jr. is probably going to have to resign from Congress, and he's going to be indicted or going to plead guilty to problems. This happened right after the election was over. And so if this happens 3, 4, 5 times, then you begin to worry.
But high-level intelligence folks are saying now that there's no relationship to what happened in Benghazi and this situation involving General Petraeus. How can you say that this early?
Well, I thought it was interesting, though, looking back, that the Republicans and, right-leaning folks, no one thought to blame Petraeus for this sneak attack on the consulate there. And all the while, I thought, well, gosh darn, where was the CIA here? How can we get surprised by this ragtag group of local jihadists? That just didn't make a lot of sense to me from the get-go. But nobody was down on the CIA or Petraeus.
Wait a
Why
minute.
Was
the,
that?
The Democratic line was that this was a all of a sudden spontaneous complaint about a video. You can't have both. You can't have it both ways. You can't say that it was planned and the CIA should have known about it and argue right up to the day of the election that it was somehow spontaneous.
You say we're complaining about a video. The president was very quick to say it was an orchestrated terrorist act.
Oh, baloney. Come on,
should,
John.
The Rose Garden.
Terribly quick.
Come
on,
the Rose Garden.
On. He made should, references
should
to
Petraeus,
terrorists.
Should Petraeus appear before the Benghazi inquiry?
I think he obviously should appear, yes, even after the fact, to clear the air. Perception alone dictates he should appear.
Is it fair that he should be questioned in that committee also about this other issue and whether or not it might have had some impact on national security, perhaps?
Let's face it, you're the head of the CIA, and you're caught in a compromising situation. You are automatically in a position of potential blackmailability.
Right.
So, yes, I'm sorry, but any claim to privacy went out the window the day he took that job.
And also, according to some of the reports, most notably today in the Washington Post, it appears that some of his senior staff members were very upset about the closeness that he had with Paula Broadwell, and we'll talk more about her and get your reaction. 1-800-723-8029, the reaction to the resignation of General Petraeus, and then we're going to switch gears and talk about the results of last Tuesday, election night. Back shortly. From Tyler, Texas to Taylorville, Illinois, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway on America's great radio stations as well as Sirius and XM satellite radio. We're going to spend a little more time about talking about the Petraeus situation, and then we're going to move to calls and then move on to campaign 2012. Mike, let's look at the situation involving Petraeus. Mm-hmm. Someone with that much power, that much reputation, that much admired by all people of all stripes, the fall is significant and a personal tragedy.
It is. It's absolutely a tragedy. And the guy was a hero to so many people. And he was married for 30. He is married for 37 years. And it's just we're all capable of being lured into such a situation. We have to constantly be on watch to not do that. And plus, when you're in that kind of a position of being the head of the CIA, it can't be. It's just about sex. Of course, that's what we heard when it was the president. Mm-hmm. But this is a case that you just can't have this. It just can't be done.
Well, also it was said that he was very much into mentoring young students, and she was a graduate of West Point.
Mm-hmm.
She was extremely bright. She liked to run as he did. But again, in these stories in the Washington Post today, what's disturbing about it, there is more than one source. They're unidentified sources, but it's more than just one person being alluded to, in that there were a number of senior staff that were worried about her access, about her apparent lack of training, journalistic training, to be handed the title of biographer of General Petraeus. And again, when the book came out in January, she made an appearance on on the Jon Stewart The Daily Show. And when she was on the show, some might describe that she was dressed rather provocatively for an author who was selling a book about a biography about the head of the Central Intelligence Agency. John, again, let's get back to the staff. And should the staff or could the staff have gone anywhere else? There's no record that anybody went to General Petraeus and said, hey, a minute, you can't have her around you.
Well, it's hard to go to the boss and confront a boss. And you know, and this guy, you know, used to jump out of airplanes and lead the 101st Airborne. It's not.
But wouldn't that have been a little curious to you? Because again, even when she was, when she made the trips to Afghanistan with him, there were questions, and she was criticized for the seductive way in which she dressed.
Mm. It certainly raises many questions, and obviously different bosses have different means of running an organization, Bruce. There are some who simply surround themselves with yes men. I would have been I'm surprised if that was the case with Petraeus. I'm surprised that there weren't people on his staff who were empowered to say, hey, boss, this has got to stop.
Well, I think we're going to probably learn more about that.
Yeah, I would hope so. It's no comparison. I was a chairman of a department at DePaul, and I had a colleague. I told her, I said, there's one thing I want you to be. I want you to be my practical voice behind the scenes. If I do something stupid, I want you to tell me, because other people may not, or I may not even know I'm doing something stupid. And I think good management requires that kind of openness, that there at least be somebody else.
Is there anyone at the table who thinks he should not have resigned?
No, given the sensitivity of the nature. It's one thing, for example, if you're Arnold Schwarzenegger and you're governor of California, what are the blackmail possibilities? But here, I mean, let's face it, we now know that John Kennedy was sleeping with a mafia don's mall, for Pete's sake. That was an impeachable offense.
Mm-hmm. Had we known. Well, of course, a lot of Kennedy files would say, well, that was his personal life. And you should keep his personal life separate from his public life.
They're
I think
wrong.
The question is,
you can't
can you really do that?
They may say that, and they're dead wrong.
Right. Let's go to Bryant, listening to us in Redding, California, on KQMS. Nice to hear from Northern California today.
Thank you. Oh, thank you, and congratulations to the Obama camp. The reason I'm calling is that, when I first heard about this, then there was a statement, I think it was made by the president, that General Petraeus would not have to be speaking with the Senate Oversight Committee. And I go, that ain't going to be right, especially after all that went down in Benghazi and everything that happened in the Situation Room. He's going to have to say what they knew and did not know.
I hope he does, because I think a lot of Republicans are going to be very disappointed in what he has to say about what went down there.
It's not in terms of Republicans, more than the entire citizens of the United States. I'm a U.S. Navy veteran. I worked in
Yeah,
the
well, country. So am I.
I've worked in that. And the one thing I do know is to say that they didn't know what was going down, and then telling these Woods and the other guy to stand down, no, that's unacceptable at any time.
Well, there is some issue here that they would just add to the conspiracy theory, wouldn't it, if he didn't testify? And on top of that, at least according to what I saw online just today, that Secretary Clinton can't be available to testify soon because her schedule is so busy.
And he's going to have to testify.
I would think so.
I would think so, too.
But the word is right now that she's not available in the near future. If you want a conspiracy theory to germinate from this, go ahead and have him not testify.
Yeah, he has to testify, and to the extent possible, he has got to testify in open session.
Right.
There will be parts of this that have to be behind closed doors, but as much as possible should be right out there.
Or it could be Morrell. I mean, it doesn't have to be him. I mean, anyone who has knowledge of what the CIA knew through the whole episode.
But why shouldn't it be him, John?
Well, if it's him, fine. All I'm saying is trying to make this, what did you know, when did you know it, and all this stuff. when the CIA says what they knew and when they knew it, people are going to be disappointed if you're still grinding that axe trying to get Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton.
No, I'm not trying to get Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton. The election is over. Obama won. But the question is,
O'Brien.
There's two questions here. Question number one is, what were the actions of the CIA and everyone involved in the State Department leading up to and during the first cables from Benghazi that there were problems? There were problems, again, several weeks
before. I want to know why the CIA didn't know it 3 days before this all happened.
That's what I
want to know. Never mind what happened after the shooting started.
And what I also want to know is if the director of the CIA, who conceivably, and I say conceivably, could maybe have been under some personal duress because of what we know now. Maybe there was some indication. I cannot believe that if once Paula Broadwell was interviewed by the FBI and she might have mentioned Petraeus's name. In fact, there was communication, as I understand, between Broadwell and Petraeus about that interview. I can't believe that this buttoned up four-star general would not be somewhat diluted, not totally thrown off in the road, but diluted by that personal thing that was hanging over his head when maybe some very important decisions were about to be made. Now, that is about national security that is triggered by one's personal problems. You cannot separate. And the people that say, that's a personal issue. In this case, I don't think you can separate one's personal conduct from what conceivably might have been mistakes made by the CIA.
I agree. True. And having said that, though, I would add one thing, and that is this. This is a man who has made an entire career based on grace under pressure. And while there are people certainly who would be susceptible to that charge, I would think that David Petraeus would be among the least likely to be.
David in Wilmington, Illinois, listens to us on WLS, and you're on the air coast to coast.
Yeah, I think it is a national security issue. But my thinking is this is dirty politics, and what I mean by that is I think they knew about this long ago.
Who's they?
And
who's they?
David, who's they? Well, let's put it this way. Whoever is asking him to step down, I think they knew this all along. And so now that it's convenient for him to get out of the picture, they dropped the ball. And furthermore, if you want to look at it, look what's in the news. We don't hear about Benghazi and all the screw-ups about Benghazi. Now it's, who was Dave Petraeus being with and who was he messing around with? That's not the issue. The issue is Benghazi, how it's treated, when this guy Petraeus did his thing. Yeah, that's important, but I bet they knew about this long ago, not just a few days ago.
Well, there's only one they who could possibly ask the director of the CIA to step down. That would be the president.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe
in this particular case, he volunteered to do it,
yeah.
And the president did not take his immediate resignation. He wanted to sleep on it for a night, and he accepted it the next day. And that's what we at least believe we know right at the moment. Let's go to Arlington Heights, Illinois, where Charlotte is listening to us on 89. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. In regard to General Petraeus, I thought I heard that he could volunteer to testify or he could be subpoenaed as a civilian by the Congressional Committee. And I don't remember the source, maybe a congressman or someone involved with the Defense Department. But what keeps him from volunteering to testify?
Mm-hmm. Well, again, I think to me, I think he will do the honorable thing and testify. And I know, I don't know if you saw the morning shows today, but again, Dianne Feinstein, who was reelected as a Democrat in California overwhelmingly, she is chair of the House Senate Oversight Committee. And again, she was very, very upset. I mean, she talked in a very serious human way about the personal tragedy of David Petraeus. But she also talked and was very, she had her back up about being that chairman and not having received information from the FBI about this investigation. That is the law. If there's anything that pertains to national security at the highest levels, she is supposed to know about it, as well as the other three members of that committee. It didn't happen. It was and she wants to investigate that, and she should, because that's why we have oversight oversight committees to give oversight. And Dianne Feinstein was not treated with the respect that she deserved. She happens to be, in my opinion, one of the best United States senators we've ever had. Back shortly from Chicago. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thank you very much for joining us this evening. Our Democrat is John McCarron. He is an adjunct professor and lecturer at DePaul University, where he teaches journalism, and a former longtime member of the Tribune editorial board. Also does some contributing work over at the Chicago Tribune. Also joining us this evening is Mike Miller. He is an associate professor of economics at DePaul. He's been there for a long, long time, over 30 years.
32 years,
and hails from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And Jim Bohannon also joins us, one of the best talk show hosts in America, 53 years in the business, 14th year last night as the announcer on the National Radio Hall of Fame broadcast, which originated from this location. And also, again, you've been with us for a long time, and a member of the National Radio Hall of Fame. You're wearing your little lapel pin, and we're so proud that you do that. On this, by the way, before we go too much further and run out of time, I do want to take a moment to pay tribute to all of the veterans who are listening to the program this evening. Again, we thank you very much for your service, regardless of where it was or when it was. Tomorrow is a special day for you, and we hope that for those of you who have never served, we hope that tomorrow you will take a moment, give a little silent prayer to those that gave their lives and still alive to tell the story of their battles for the in support of our freedoms that we cherish so much in the United States. So again, to all of our veterans, thank you for your wonderful service to this country. Let's now talk about campaign 2012. We've got 90 minutes left. Mike Miller, my question to you as a Republican. Did Mitt Romney lose this election, or did Barack Obama win it?
I think Barack Obama won the election. I think Mitt Romney put up a good fight. There was the problem that we never quite knew exactly which Mitt it was. He did change positions, and I didn't care for that very much. But he's a fine man. He ran a fine campaign. And we got to do some soul searching, but not too much. I think the basic idea behind Republican philosophy is still correct. But Barack Obama won the election.
John McCarron, same question to you.
I agree with Mike. Barack Obama won it, and I think the way he won it was very interesting. We're going to be seeing a lot more of it. High technology played a huge role.
Right.
The targeting was absolutely incredible. I also teach at DePaul, and I took my class up to his the headquarters. They took an entire floor of the Prudential Plaza here in Chicago, and there was this row after row, hundreds of late teen and 20-somethings pounding away at these laptop computers. And what they were doing was sorting people, I mean, into likely supporters who they constantly went after for money. I mean, I went to his website one time, and every day I would get an email from Michelle.
Right.
Or, you know, saying, hey, John, you got it. You know, it was very, very much targeted just because I went to the website. And then they'd find out if you were an Obama or a Romney voter, well, then they didn't go near you.
Right.
If you were in the middle, then you got visited by the ground
game. Now, demographics have been used before, but they've never been used to this extent. Romney used some demographics as well, but it seemed to me that Romney was running a more traditional campaign, looking at states, looking at the map and how you move the map, whereas I think the situation involving the president and David Fluff and David Axelrod, they did this campaign with surgical precision. In some ways, this was even more of an impressive campaign than the primary campaign of 4 years ago. Jim?
Agreed, absolutely. Of course, 4 years ago, the president revolutionized the concept of fundraising, and this time, again, exactly, if you were a left-handed Lithuanian lesbian, by golly, they had a message aimed just at you. And this will be studied by many, many people, students, clearly, Republicans, obviously studying it very hard. But before Republicans get, I think, too morose or start worrying that much about their message, they should keep in mind that it was a relatively close campaign. If 225,000 votes were changed in Florida, Ohio, Virginia, and New Hampshire, we would be talking about President-elect Romney, and that's less than 0.25% of the vote. So this was not a wipeout, and the Republican soul-searching, I think, needs to be much more along the lines that we have discussed, which is to say technique as opposed to just message.
Well, it's a combination of also that, but also focus, because, again, in doing what he did is he found something. Once he knew what his coalition was, he gave each of those coalition members something. I know, you know, the first Sunday after Kathleen Sebelius came out with her HHS decision on contraceptives and what hospitals, religious hospitals, could or could not do. The Democrats immediately moved and made it a battle over contraceptives. The Republicans were trying to make it a battle over religious freedom. And the Democrats and their colleagues and their cheerleaders in the press, they made it about contraceptives. And so Sandra Fluke comes along and she becomes a hero. And so they had their issue. They had their issue for single women. They drove it home. The Latinos who had been upset with Barack Obama for backing away from all of the promises that he made about immigration reform, he got them back when he went with the executive order on the DREAM Act. The gays were upset with him because he didn't move fast enough on gays in the military. Boom. Gays in the military. So he reaches out to them. He already had the African-American community. The blue-collar worker in Ohio and Michigan, he had them wrapped up when he talked about the auto bailout. It was a decision that Romney made. There was a difference between the two. Romney tried to backtrack about that. But again, he got his white ethnic voters, primarily union voters, in Northwest Ohio and southern and most of the state of Michigan. So he did that. And then what he was able to do, he was able to jack up his turnout in those areas, even though he got 8 million fewer votes than 4 years ago. He got the right people out, and surgically he went through all of that because he gave something to everybody. And Mitt Romney, again, being the conventional candidate, was on message. He was talking about jobs. He was talking about the economy. He was talking about his credentials. And he was talking to a much broader audience. But again, the Obama campaign was surgically going after every single demographic group and giving them a huge goodie.
Wow, I could not have said it better than that. If there's one thing I do see as a – I'm Republican, and I believe I'm basically conservative, as I think that Mitt Romney was trying to speak conservative and he wasn't. I think that the philosophy that the Republicans have is the right philosophy, and the country will prosper under it. And the one thing I hope that the Republicans do not do is to go after groups the way that the Democrats do. What they owe everybody everything, and what he did is he gave away a bunch of stuff to individuals, and it's going to be all against each other. And I just – that, to me, that's a terrible philosophy. They have no centralized thought process that says this is what makes a society successful. The Republicans do.
He was also, I think, absolutely put behind the eight ball in the Republican primary. In the Republican primary, in an effort to get the primary, it was very divisive. It created a problem. And when you talk about the image of Mitt Romney, that he was this bad, evil guy and the bane and all of that, the message of bane and the greediness that Romney allegedly had, which the president spent $100 million in hammering during a three-month period in the spring and early summer, hammering that in all of the major states, certainly Ohio and Michigan and the industrial Northeast. In doing that, he was picking up the message, and who was the first messenger? It was Newt Gingrich. Newt Gingrich and, to a lesser extent, Rick Perry brought up the Bain issue, brought up the question about how greedy Romney was. And that Republican primary message was picked up by the Democrats and marketed to the tune of $100 million.
Well, they were going to use it anyway, but I think they were delighted to see the Republicans.
If it had not been brought up in the primaries, I'm not so sure that the issue would have taken off, because again, the news media was carrying the water for the Democrats, as they generally do. I don't think you would have had that three-month period that would have been as credible if Newt Gingrich had not already made it an issue in the Republican primary. He was the one that moved it forward, and they just picked up on what he was saying.
Now their opposition research people were ready to go with it. I think they were ready
to go with it, I understand, John. But the fact that there was $100 million of basically unanswered negative character assassination about Mitt Romney.
It's nice having not to run in a primary because you have money early
Absolutely.
On. You know, we saw that in Senate races where we had a Republican, Tommy Thompson in Wisconsin, just had to go right during the primary, had to spend all his money, and he got upset.
Is there a way to get around that, Jim? Because, again, that's traditional. The Democrats run left. Again, Barack Obama won because he went to the left of Hillary Clinton. Romney went to the right because he thought he had to go to the right, even though I don't think there's anybody at this table that believes that he is not a moderate.
We have seen a great polarization of the country, and the parties have become very ideological. The idea of blue dog Democrats or moderate Republicans is very passé. And so, inevitably, as long as you've got very conservative Republican primary electorates and very liberal Democratic primary electorates, this phenomenon is going to continue. And only when you find a lack of any kind of a party battle are you going to escape it. And then you're going to have to do the tap dance back to the center during the general election.
But do you think that going back to I think probably the worst thing that Mitt Romney said in the primary debates was on the issue of illegal immigration, when he used the term self-deportation.
Yeah.
Did he really? I mean, he was running at that time. He was running against Perry, who had a good record with Latinos in Texas. He was running against Newt Gingrich, who was certainly part of the McCain, Kennedy plan. I mean, he was more moderate on that. Newt was probably the most liberal on that particular issue. Why did Romney think that he had to be the furthest right on that issue?
I there are two issues that bothered me. One was the China issue, that he was going to declare them a currency manipulator from the first day. I wanted to strangle him over that. And the second one is, I think it's inconsistent with my view of what Republican thinking is, that immigration is a good thing. Now, you have every right. Every country has the right to control its borders. And the first thing we should do is control the border. But we have all these wonderful people that should become Americans.
So what, do we just throw open the borders?
We're
going to pause. 1-800-723-8229. I promise we're not going to get into a discussion of illegal immigration, but we will talk about how it affected this campaign when we come back. Bruce Dumont from Chicago, thanks for joining us tonight. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Before we go to calls, let me also mention that one of the other things that happened is for the umpteenth election in a row, the Republican candidate won a majority of the white male vote, and the rest of the constituency went elsewhere. Looking at how the composition of white voters in America versus non-white voters, in 2004, 77% of the electorate was white, 23% non-white. In 2008, it was 74% was white, 27% non-white. And in the most recent election, 72%, down 5 percentage points of white voters in America in 2012. Non-whites had gone from 23% to 28%. And in those key battleground states, in the state of Ohio, in 2008, 83% of the vote was white. Last Tuesday, it had dropped to 79%. Non-white voters, 4 years ago, 17%. This year, 21%. That's just in the swing state of Ohio. Then let's look at Florida. In Florida, 4 years ago, 71% of the vote was white. Last Tuesday, 67% of the vote was white. 4 years ago, non-white voters in Florida, 29%. Up this year to 34%. So the demographics, they are changing in all parts of the country. And let's look at the map. Let's look at where the states with the highest Latino population. They are California, Nevada, New Mexico, Colorado, Illinois, Florida, New York, New Jersey, all went for Obama. That's 167 electoral votes that the Democrats are likely to start with, although there's a couple of swing states in there. And then the only two states where there's high Latino population that went Republican, mm-hmm. Arizona, which could be the next state to go blue, and Texas at 38 electoral votes. But again, Republicans would start with only 49 electoral votes. So the demographics are just, they're massive. They are against this generation of Republican political leadership. They are out of touch with either the messages or the messengers. Jim, how do the Republicans make peace? And Rush Limbaugh was talking about this the other day. How do they make peace and amends with a large and growing Latino community? By the way, we should also mention they lost the Asian community by large numbers.
Well, looking at just the numbers you just cited here, it's interesting to note that in a bad economy, which has had the most tepid rate of recovery in recent memory under this administration, where the Republicans put forward the message of economic growth, that the more likely you were statistically to be unemployed, that is to say Latino or black, the more likely you were to vote for the current tepid recovery, which is rather an interesting statistic in and of itself. Now, I think you can very frankly say that there were an awful lot of African Americans who voted for Obama because of race. There may be many other factors. There may be a number of those who are, in fact, ideologically inclined to agree with him. But in terms of the Latinos, you have a situation here where I think that unless you just are going to say that all Latinos or a large majority of Latinos want close to open borders, then it's hard for me to understand what the appeal was.
Well, I don't think there's – Mike, I want to get your reaction mm-hmm. and John's reaction to that, and then I'm going to move on to another topic that's tied to it.
Yeah, I believe that there's a natural connection between the Republican philosophy of again, what makes a society great and what makes an economy grow and what Latinos fail. I live in a village which is about 35 to 40% Hispanic. There's a natural connection there. If we could just have the right person selling it, I'm just not sure that Mr. Romney was the right person to sell it.
So what, a Rubio?
Yes, maybe a Rubio, but just philosophically,
again,
the hard work.
In other words, nothing Mitt Romney could have done short of time in a tanning salon was going to change this vote.
No,
that's not a very nice thing.
No,
to
just
say.
The
idea. No, I
just
but I do believe
basic
that. I mean,
philosophy.
Well, John, I want to get your reaction, then I'll make my comment.
Well, yeah, I spend a lot of time studying cities, not politics. And if it weren't for Hispanics, a lot of Chicago neighborhoods would have gone down the drain a long time ago. You know, they move in. They tend to have jobs and
yes.
not
yeah.
be filing.
Although they have a higher unemployment rate than whites, but
yes, but yeah. lower than blacks. But
lower than blacks.
Well,
that's
lower.
Right.
They're hardworking folks. They fix up their homes. They fix up their mother-in-law apartments. They bring in other family members. Like I say, they've saved a lot of neighborhoods in Chicago. That's my parochial view. However, they don't vote. In nearly as large a percentage of their raw numbers. I mean, we have a lot of suburbs around Chicago, like Berwyn, for instance, is 80% Hispanic and has an Italian city council. Well, why is that? Well, because Hispanics typically just don't vote in proportion to their population.
But in this election, certainly at the presidential level, the way that's being analyzed, I mean, they got the president got 71%.
That's right.
And again, when George Bush ran the first time, he got 40%. 40% of the mm-hmm. Hispanic vote, and he did very well in getting the Hispanic vote when he was the governor of Texas, as did Rick Perry.
Yeah.
So there's something about the way in which Republicans talk about issues.
That's correct.
That the message, the messenger, the tone that Texas Republicans use is different than other Republicans.
I think it's
if you're listening to us, by the way, on KLBJ in Austin, Texas, I would really like you to call in and share your thoughts on that. We've got some Texas callers on the line. We're going to hear from them shortly. 1-800-723-8029. We continue our discussion, our analysis of Campaign 2012 with your calls when we continue. 1-800-723-8029. That's 1-800-723-8029. Our Democrat is John McCarron, and our talk show host is Jim Bohannon from Dial Global Radio Networks. Our Republican is Mike Miller. They will all be back for the next hour on radio. We'll take more calls, 1-800-723-8029. Your chance to offer your 2 cents on Campaign 2012, the final analysis tonight on Beyond the Beltway. You're watching us on television. We'll see you next week. If you're listening on radio, stay right where you are. We'll be back after network news. From Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont. We continue with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics. Tonight, featuring commentary by Democrat John McCarron, Republican Mike Miller, and network talk show host Jim Bohannon from the Dial Global Radio Networks. Our base, coming to you from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago, where our toll-free lines remain open at 1-800-723-8029. We're talking about the election of past Tuesday, giving everybody an opportunity to offer their assessment of the differences between the way Romney ran his campaign and the way that the president ran his campaign, and suggesting in the first hour that there was a surgical precision and certainly an awareness of a 21st century campaign focus that the Obama campaign brought to the battle. And Romney, although a businessman, maybe not quite up to the task of managing a successful presidential campaign, and talking also about whether or not Mitt Romney really got tarred and feathered in the primary, that the primary process hurt him and was never able to really recover from some of those issues that were taken. And then, of course, the mastery of the Obama folks to use those slings and arrows that were cast Romney's way, to use them with a $100 million campaign that further defined Romney. And if you can define your opponent before your opponent can define you, you will win about 100% of the campaigns. And that's one of the things I think that happened this year. We got lots of callers on the line. We've touched a nerve. Everybody wants to jump in with their two cents. Let's head to El Paso, Texas, where Steve is listening to us on KTSM. Nice to hear from Texas tonight. Go ahead, Steve.
Hey, hi, Bruce. Hi, Jimbo and everyone.
Hi. Hello.
I think that y'all are overanalyzing this a bit. It's really not anything more complicated than a Roman writer by the name of Juvenal said many years ago. He said, democracies will fail once the populace realizes that they can vote themselves bread and circuses. And I believe that we are seeing that tipping point reached within our country. It kind of saddens me.
Mike Miller was saying that during one of the breaks.
Yes, I agree with you. I think that that's a failed policy. It certainly got him elected, but I don't think it can make the country run. And I think that if you've promised all these goodies, who's going to pay for it? You're going to eventually run out of my money to pay for other people to have stuff who aren't producing a whole lot. And I just don't think you can run a country based upon promising people goodies from the government where you take from one, give to another.
In reality, I want to ask you, Steve, we'll give you the last word. In reality, when Mitt Romney made his comment about the 47%, even though it was politically inopportune to say it, wasn't he dead on right, John?
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot, too, that he knew he wasn't going to get. In fact, he almost hit the percentage on the
absolutely
nose, didn't he?
Exactly,
almost hit 48%.
Right.
What I was going to add is, we're getting back to Juvenal and Steve from Texas, is that maybe it's the same way with doctors getting their fat Medicare payments and their tax-deductible BMWs or hedge fund managers who pay taxes at 15%. I mean, the amazing thing to me about Republicans is they don't think they're on the goody train. When, if you look closely at where the money goes, it doesn't stick with the people who are on, on Medicare or Medicaid. It ends up helping someone buy a summer home on the Jersey Shore.
Jim Bohannon.
I would just note that an awful lot of doctors are giving up even going toward government program patients.
Of course.
So you're going to have to wonder where those patients are going to go. How many doctors are taking Medicare
Medicaid fewer and patients? Fewer and fewer. Part of the fiscal cliff that's coming up is going to be they're going to reduce the payments to doctors by $15 billion. So you think you want to go to grad medical school for 10 years and put all that money and borrow all that money and then come out and have somebody do that to you?
Federally subsidized medical schools, yes.
But the question, Steve, I want to go back to you for a follow-up. Go ahead.
Well, first of all, don't anyone think that I'm a Republican. I never voted Republican or Democrat. But I wanted to say that the founders of our country, they knew that a direct democracy would be a problem. They took a lot of time to set up a representative republic with checks and balances, tricameral system of government. And I think that over the last 230 years, that has eroded to the point where we are seeing the insidious problems that arise from direct democracy, and that will be our downfall.
There's one number I wanted to bring to the table. That is, I believe it was in 2011, that the federal government spent $3.8 trillion. $1.2 was on goods and services. All the rest was transfer payments from people to people. So I'm not judging whether that's right or wrong, and it seems like Americans want to take from one and give to another in larger and larger quantities, and you can't do that.
Yeah. Joanne in Schaumburg, Illinois on WLS. You're on Coast to Coast. Go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I kind of weigh in differently on this election than you have, Bruce. I know you called it surgical precision. I call it a bag full of dirty tricks. You know, this president has created a divided country over the past 4 years. He ran a campaign based on class warfare, war on women, and accusations of racism repeatedly. He courted the young, uninformed college students, pandering to them about college costs and lowering their interest payments. By the way, the way they're lowering their interest payments, it was in the Wall Street Journal, they're taking from pension funds. Then
that was another one of those goodies to that surgically focused on group. It was one of the groups that I didn't mention in my litany before, but again, young people were in there. And again, this is important. In every one of those initiatives, they had the cheerleaders in the media who believe that they were all good ideas.
Bruce, you got to follow the money. Where does that tuition money go? Do you think the students hold on to it, or does it end up going to buy some for-profit college executives BMW or Mercedes?
Well, I think it goes to in a large extent. It does go to that, and you're right. But what I'm saying is, I'm looking at it politically. That was another group that again was promised something, and that's another reason why they turned out. Plus, and I think we cannot overestimate this. Barack Obama is terminally hip. He is the darling of young people, and when you juxtapose him against a guy who, like Tom Dewey, looked like he should have been on a wedding cake, I said that, and I meant this, and I've said it before, Mitt Romney was the most vilified candidate ever to run for political office, with the exception of Barry Goldwater.
So terminally,
now we vilified presidents, but again, to vilify a candidate basically because of his success, the way he looked, the fact that he was successful, I mean, that was, in my view, that was an un-American way of looking at it, and I think to the issue of class warfare. But you know what? It works.
Well, it did work, but I mean, again, if terminally hip is going to be our standard, what do we get ready for President Justin Timberlake? I mean,
well, but
maybe.
Good Lord. One of the big differences in the turnout, the Republicans lost in terms of the Hispanic vote, and they lost in terms of the young vote. People
well,
under 30.
If down were that shallow, then
well,
there are
no, under
a lot
30,
of good things about being
a lot
my
of people,
age, but one of them is not being around to see where that goes.
But one of the other things that, again, just insofar as the media situation, is to look at the way in which Mitt Romney, again, was almost up until the very end. He didn't want to do the Sunday morning shows, and yet you look at the entertainment shows. You couldn't turn on television in the last 2 weeks. It was Jay Leno. It was the Jay Leno show one night. It was the David Letterman show the next night. Then there was Michelle Obama on with Ellen, and then they were on The View. I mean, every place where you looked at entertainment talk, the Obamas were on there dominating it. And Mitt Romney, he was off doing something. He was talking to some, you know, crowd in Ohio about something. But again, he missed the point, because the people that watched The Tonight Show, the people more so than even The David Letterman Show, the people that watched The Tonight Show, they make up that 6% of the people who are not necessarily politically tuned in, and their vote counts as much as anyone's at this table. 1-800-723-8029. I'm Bruce Dumont, back with your calls and a lot more calls in a few minutes. From Ohio to Texas, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. Thank you very much for joining us tonight. Let's head to Steve in Grantham, New Hampshire, listening to us on WNTK, one of the pivotal states. And it went for Barack Obama in a big way. Steve, go ahead.
Yeah, maybe I can make a few quick points, and then I'd love to hear the comments. One is, I think Jim last hour talked about roughly a quarter of a million votes or 225,000 votes in various swing states would have thrown the election the other way. I think that minimizes the impact of this particular election and the trend that this election obviously is showing. Hell, in 2000, 200 votes could have turned the election. So, I mean, a quarter of a million is actually a lot of votes. Second thing, I think, Bruce, you mentioned messenger tone. I think those are important to some extent, but the real problem for the Republicans right now is the actual message. And David Brooks had a great article on Friday. And while I'm Democratic-leaning, I would love to have a responsible Republican Party, not the people and I don't consider the Tea Party people responsible. Some people may. I think they're too far out. But David Brooks wrote and said the reason why Latinos and Asians voted for Obama is that they're not against the government. They are hardworking. There are many, obviously, in South Florida, Cubans have done a tremendous job economically. In many other parts of the country, Latinos, as someone mentioned earlier, I think the Republican, someone mentioned Chicago, how the Latinos have helped many neighborhoods. They are entrepreneurial, certainly Asians are, but they are not against the government being appropriately used. I'm not talking about being inefficiently being used. And finally, my two other quick points. New Hampshire, the state legislature in 2010 became supermajority Republicans. And in the state house, 115 changes were Democrats after being behind as a super, Republicans being a supermajority. Democrats now have the House, and in the Senate, where it was 19-5, it's 13-11 Republicans with some recounts going on.
And it's also important to announce because we've been talking about gender politics, all elected officials in the state of New Hampshire at the state level are, even in the congressional delegation, they're all women.
And when New Hampshire state legislature, they didn't talk about the economy too much. They went on social issues. So that, the message was what was wrong in New Hampshire. And the last thing is the Republicans during this election were in their own bubble, Fox News, et cetera, Karl Rove. It turns out that Nate Silver, using data, was much more attuned to what was happening than Republicans Peggy Noonan, based on her feeling that the election was going to go Romney's way.
Well, so I think that.
Thank you. I appreciate you letting me make all my points.
Thank you very much for your comment. By the way, one of the other interesting aspect about the Latino vote in Florida, which has a predominance of within the Hispanic community, has a predominance of Cuban voters
and a big Barack belt of Obama Puerto Ricans in the middle.
Puerto Ricans is the largest influx increase in Florida. But again, Barack Obama won the Cuban vote in Florida. That was significant. Before we take the next call, I just want to make
one
point.
Did I respond to the caller?
Go ahead. Respond to him.
I was just going to say, the numbers I cited were exactly accurate, number one. And number two, no one is disparaging the work ethic of Latinos, but when they have a higher than average unemployment rate, you would have to assume that that would make them unhappy, since they, in fact, do wish to work. So, again, if that Republican message was wrong, you'll have to show me where it was wrong. If I am eager to work and I have a higher than average level of unemployment, then presumably I'm not pleased.
I want to make a statement. I want to get everybody's response to it. One of the worst mistakes that Mitt Romney made was selecting Paul Ryan to be his running mate. Mike Miller.
No, I think you're wrong. I think he's the future of the party, he and a few others. He didn't win in Wisconsin, though, I must admit, but I'm surprised.
That's pretty bad.
If there was only one thing, he didn't win, and I think also Ryan did not want to outshine
Certainly Romney. Didn't do that.
He didn't do that.
It was like he could have been on a milk carton. He was so invisible except
yes,
for the
debate.
Yes,
he was a little bit, he was some, but he would have, in terms of me, if something would happen to Romney, if he had made it to president, I'd have been perfectly happy with him as president.
But again, do you believe, but everybody's response to what that my statement and Mike's opposition to my statement,
well,
Jim?
I don't know that it was the worst pick he could have made. He could have made a better pick, certainly. Very, very likely that a Rob Portman would have carried Ohio, or
yes.
a Marco Rubio would have enabled him to carry Florida.
Yes.
So you go by the traditional means of picking a running mate in that way. Yeah, probably so. There's no question about the fact that the, as they were terming it, the Ryan Romney budget probably frightened a lot of elderly people who apparently haven't bothered to look and see that we are running into a train wreck, and it is unsustainable.
And who knows more about it than Paul Ryan?
But having said that, politically, policy-wise, Paul Ryan is dead right on 100%. Politically, probably not a smart move.
But again, you don't get a chance to make policy if you don't get elected. John, your reaction to my statement?
I thought it was a bad choice. I saw a lot of good.
So we agree.
We do. I saw a lot of good-looking, articulate Hispanic candidates at the Republican convention in Tampa, and I couldn't figure why they. Or and several women who. I thought were appealing. Why he ended up with a guy who was, you know, way back there on the right. I mean, the primary had been won. We don't have. We're tacking to the center in the general election, are we not?
Right. It was like at that particular process, he was still trying to solidify the base. And other than a couple of days when, you know, Paul Ryan with his shirt off was a flutter of Facebook and tweeting all over the country to allegedly appeal to a younger demographic, the point is he didn't carry his own state. And had Rob Portman been on the ticket, it certainly would have raised the likelihood that Ohio would have gone. And there's no question that Marco Rubio, had he been on the ticket, would have carried Florida, because the difference there was only 70,000 votes. So, again, strategically, a very bad decision. And, again, when I read the books of this campaign, I want to know the machinations back and forth about how Ryan ended up. Because, again, and I don't think he's really helped himself for the future. I think there's a lot of other stronger candidates, and one other candidate that is successful. Most of the focus now has been obviously on Marco Rubio coming from Florida, being Hispanic. But again, I think in 4 years from now, Ted Cruz, the newly elected Republican senator from Texas, will be also, I think, viewed as a very serious potential contender with Marco Rubio, at least from a Hispanic standpoint, to watch the jockeying between those two Hispanics within the Republican Party. And there are many other Hispanics, the governor of New Mexico, and also, I think, who gave one of the best speeches at the Republican convention. Speaking of Texas, let us go there now. Austin, Texas is the place. KLBJ, one of the great radio stations in America, is the call letters. And Jeff, you are the caller. Go ahead.
Hey guys, how you doing tonight?
Okay.
You made a comment earlier about Texans speaking a certain language, or Republicans and Texans, that appeals to Hispanics. But I think one other aspect of that that's misunderstood is that I think a different kind of immigrant comes from Mexico to Texas than goes to California. I think we tend to draw a more conservative Mexican than we do maybe over in California.
Oh,
I think the
so
work
it's
ethic.
The, it's the Hispanic who's different. It's not
the
necessarily
food,
the message.
The Mexican food and
so tell me more about, you say it's a different Hispanic. Well, first of all, it is generally, to correct me if I'm wrong here, but I believe that what I'm about to say is true, that in Texas and certainly deeper into the country in New Mexico, it's several generations of Hispanics that are part of that voting block, where in California it may be more of a first generation Hispanic from Mexico. Is that a fair assessment in your view, Jeff?
Yeah, I'd say that's right. There's a long Tejano history in Texas, and a lot of them helped us win our independence from the dictatorship of Santa Ana in Mexico. So, absolutely.
Okay, listen, thank you for your call. We appreciate it. Let's head to Lansing, Michigan. We're picking up all the big states tonight. She's listening to us on Sirius Radio. Lisa, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks a lot. I just wanted to let you know, I sometimes find it kind of insulting when people insist that the people that are voting for President Obama are the takers, Our household income is over $250,000. Was at a party with 10 other couples this weekend. They're all in that income bracket. But I would have to say that you were 100% correct, and I'm glad they didn't listen to your advice, because Paul Ryan, if he wouldn't have picked Paul Ryan, I really think Romney would be the president right now. And these are my reasons. You can disagree with it, but this is the perception that's out there. Ryan came from the Republican House, the party of no, party over country, and he walked out of Simpson's polls. And the worst thing for women is he co-sponsored with Atkins the personhood bill, which would have made birth control illegal. Now, whether you say that wasn't Romney's position, even though Romney said if that bill comes over his desk, he would sign it, and whether you say, well, when Romney gets in office, he would or wouldn't. But those are the type of things that were insulted to independent women like me, because those are economic issues. They're not social.
That's why I think the brain trust, that they unplugged their brains when they made that decision. Here you had
the
author of the most controversial piece of legislation or suggestion or plan in Washington, D.C., and you pick him, and the minute you pick him, you're gonna start playing defense. And Romney did. Now, why you do that, I don't know. Especially when you're still not even sure he's going to carry the 10 electoral votes from Wisconsin.
Reportedly, two of them got along with each other really well. There was a real empathy between Romney and Ryan. He liked Ryan.
Well, that's good. And he can think about that for the rest of his life. What a nice guy he was, who couldn't even carry his own state. But you know what? He had so much confidence in Mitt Romney that he ran for re-election for the House. So he will still be with us. He'll be part
like
of the
Biden
discussion.
And like Lieberman and like LBJ.
We got to pause. 1-800-723-8029. When we come back, we've got Minnesota, we've got Ohio, we've got Indiana, we got the Big Ten. They're all standing by to talk to you. Back shortly. From Spokane, Washington to Mason City, Iowa, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway, 1-800-723-8029. Our Democrat tonight is John McCarron. He is an adjunct professor and a lecturer at DePaul University, where he teaches journalism, and for over 30 years he was a member of the Chicago Tribune editorial board and as part of their editorial team, also does contributing work for them. Mike Miller also joins us. He is an associate professor of economics for 32 years at DePaul University. Also, we got two DePaul spokespeople tonight. They are on opposite sides of the political fence. And Jim Bohannon joins us. He is the talk show host extraordinaire on many of America's great radio stations in the evening hours. And he's been doing it for 20 years, almost 20 years.
Almost 20 years.
And, again, a member of the Radio Hall of Fame in town for the big show last night, hosted by Geraldo Rivera. We had a great turnout. If you watched or heard by the broadcast, I thought that Johnny Bench of the Cincinnati Reds, the Hall of Famer, I think he sort of stole the show. I don't think anybody knew that he was as funny or as talented. He does great voices, and again, if you had a chance to hear the show last evening, we hope you enjoyed it, and again, if you did not hear it or see it, we will have it on the museum.tv website. You can watch it, the Radio Hall of Fame from 2012. That'll be launched tomorrow at noon on our website, museum.tv. We've got more people coming in from the Big Ten. Let's go to South Bend, Indiana, where Brad is listening to us. Go ahead. You're on the air.
How guys doing tonight?
Okay.
I want to talk briefly. You're communications TV guys. I want to talk briefly about how similar to 2004 this election appeared to be in the manner in which the winning side conducted its campaign.
Mm-hmm.
I think in 2004, the architect, Karl Rove, he spent the summer taking what really should have been a strength, and that's Kerry's service in Vietnam, military service, and turned it into a vulnerability. Now,
that's right.
I lean Democratic, but I discussed with my friends then that that type of approach was silly. It would never work, that it would backfire. But it didn't. It was effective. So following the Rove blueprint, Pluff and Axelrod took, and again, I'm a Democrat, but they took what absolutely should have been a strength, and that's Romney's business experience.
Right.
By all objective measures, that should have been a strength, and they turned it into a vulnerability.
Absolutely. So, and by the way, I think your comparison is dead on. You're absolutely right. In 2004, it was swift boating. It was Karl Rove. It was the use of massive money. And again, in defining John Kerry before John Kerry could really define himself. And then, of course, when John Kerry, when he went to accept the nomination, he said reporting for duty.
Yeah.
It just reinforced the military line, which then, in my view, got way out of whack. But again, it changed the campaign. And you're absolutely right.
Yeah, I think, and this is my proposition that I'd like to hear. You guys are experts. I'm not. My proposition is that in 2004 we veered off the deep end and into more of a. And again, I'm 52 years old. I've been at it for a long time, and I consider myself an informed voter. But I have never seen such a sociopathic campaign strategy that was followed in 2004. It was again followed to the T, and I'm a Democrat in 2012. I think it's going to make it difficult for any challenger ever to defeat an incumbent president who will have all spring and summer to define that challenger.
Well, I think it's a very good point, and again, I think it may be a long time before any Republican candidate. I know Christopher Ruddy of Newsmax wrote this in his analysis. I mean, to have someone who not only had wealth but had tremendous access to wealth, I don't know whether we're going to have a Republican candidate for president that's going to be able to raise the type of money that Mitt Romney was able to raise, because in 4 years from now, you're going to have a primary on the Democratic side and the Republican side. Can you imagine what your television's, what your primetime programming is going to be like with all that television ad dollars bought?
It'll be full. I would like to address a point that the caller brought up as regards incumbency. Twice in our history, we have elected 3 2-term presidents back to back: Jefferson, Madison, Monroe from 1800 to 1824, and just now. Those are the only two times that we've done that.
Mm-hmm. And we should also mention that although we're talking about President Obama and what he's going to do in the next, or we're analyzing how he got to be in a position where he's going to be controlling things for the next 4 years, let's not forget that the Republicans retained control of the House.
Mm-hmm.
And the Founding Fathers wanted the House of Representatives to run every 2 years. They wanted them to be closest to the real mood of the people. And the mood of the people, despite the fact that allegedly, according to every poll, nobody has any confidence in Congress. Congress basically was reelected. There was a slight change in the United States Senate where two very flawed candidates.
Yeah.
They misspoke. But again, even in the area, in the situation of Todd Akin, who, again, the national media as well as the Democrats sort of tied in to this war on women. The reality was, I cannot imagine that Romney or the RNC or any of the major leaders of the Republican Party could have done more to try to get Todd Akin out of the race. He didn't do it. He didn't do it, and he helped lead to that re-election of Claire McCaskill, which I don't think anybody—it's not a bet anyone would have taken at the beginning of the cycle. Let us now head to the next Big Ten state, Ohio. Hubbard, Ohio, that's northeast Ohio. Jack is listening. Go ahead. You're on the air listening to us on WKBN.
That's right, Bruce. And last week, if you remember, and I'm sure you do, you said that the Mahoning Valley within a 200 or so radius would play a big part in electing Obama.
Yes.
And you were correct on that, my friend.
Yes.
And I think Romney hung himself out to dry when he talked about the 47% that he won't pay attention to. And the fact that, as you know, I know you said you were through Hubbard here not too long ago. We're just a few miles from Pennsylvania,
mm-hmm.
and we're right in the area where the Cruise is being built here in northeast Ohio.
Right.
And it is a lot of auto workers around here and Delphi Packard people.
Right.
And when they hear somebody say, let it go bankrupt.
Bankruptcy is a means of keeping a business afloat? Is that not known?
Apparently
bankruptcy
not.
Is not a means of driving a stake through the heart of a company. Bankruptcy is a process by which you can take a company in trouble and keep it going. Again, and no knock on the caller, but economic illiteracy is a real problem in this country.
Yeah, and take into account that when they went under, the bondholders are supposed to be the first one to receive the money, and the government essentially said, no, we're going to give the company to the unions, and the bondholders are going to lose what legal right they had. So they had to violate normal contractual law between bondholders and the auto
company. But they'll keep that in mind the next time they buy bonds.
What you had in this campaign is you had a clear understanding by the vast majority of the voters that Barack Obama was the guy that bailed out General Motors and the automotive agent industry. And then you had compared that to Mitt Romney, who had to give a convoluted description like we've just had here about what the true value was and what you know ways in which bankruptcy could have used. When you get into that discussion, you're in the haze, you're losing voters. And the fact that that line was drawn again, not only in fact, but again, with several hundred million dollars in campaign ads, I mean that's why Northeast Ohio and the entire state of Michigan went the other way. Let's head to another Big Ten state. Let's head north, Duluth, Minnesota. Listening to us on WLS, you're on the air.
Hi, my Latino friend, who's an independent, said the critical thing was the Arizona law. He felt that it was racial profiling, and that he will not stand for racism anymore. And also, my other thought on that is that the Democrats controlled the message. To me, it's deception, but on these issues, the Democrats were able to spin things their way.
I've read Senate Bill 1017 in Arizona, by the way, and that language in that bill goes out of their way. Every other paragraph is an impediment to anybody racially profiling.
Of course.
Read the bill.
Supreme Court has already had their say on it. On top of that, the Arizona law is essentially the American national law saying that we're going to enforce what you won't enforce. And on top of that, Mr. Obama was cheering about how many people he's deported. For heaven's sake, you can't have it both ways. You can't tell me that you're this lover of an immigration, but do these other things. And I don't think the Arizona law is an issue.
And that's another thing. I mean, here's an example of 71% of the American Hispanic voters voted for Barack Obama. He's tightened up the borders more than any other president. A lot of Republicans don't like to acknowledge that.
That's good.
There have been more arrests, a vast majority of more arrests under Barack Obama. And the number of deportations, I believe, is almost doubled under Barack Obama. And with all that going for him, 71% of the Hispanics voted for him because of the perception that the Republicans don't like his
parents. Well, he also gave them something. He gave them the Dream Act, which is not a bad idea. It's just that it goes against what Congress passed, and the president overrode it by an executive order.
And it is a magnet to everybody. But if you can get here and get a kid here, by golly, they're home free.
And one reason this is a big issue is because we have a rich country with very very generous welfare payments right next to a poor country. No other country has that. A
couple of other major things that happened. The voters speaking from coast to coast. Gay marriage, an issue that continues to just move down the highway in the state of Maine and in the state of Maryland. For the first time, voters approved the concept and the practice of same-sex marriage.
31
times. It wasn't the court doing it.
That had failed.
Right, 31 times it had failed. But now Maine and Maryland, again, the voters decide there. And in California and in the state of Washington, recreational pot is now legal. Again, it runs into what the federal laws are, and it could create a lot of havoc for law enforcement people. But again, the first states to legalize pot recreationally, and again in California. In California, which is the worst economic basket case of all of our states, they voted a proposition. They voted to raise taxes. Back more from Chicago. Rooster Mott back in Chicago. By the way, I might have misspoke in the last segment. The two states that legalized recreational pot, the state of Washington and the state of Colorado.
Yeah.
That's
I
right.
think I might have said California, so hopefully there's not everybody in California that's listening that's now lighting up. Remember, you can only smoke pot if for medicinal purposes. So if you have a hangnail or a cold sore, I don't know whether that is covered, but please, I don't want to be encouraging pot smoking in California. Not that my admonition is going to have any effect on those that are out there toting up. By the way, let me mention that what we're going to be doing as this program moves forward, as we move out of analysis of this campaign. If not every week, at least every couple of weeks, we're going to try to delve into one of the major issues facing the country, including the issues, the fiscal brink that we are on. We're going to spend a lot of time talking about that in the next several months and certainly for the next couple of years on this program. So it's, you know, we've gone through this campaign. As I said, it's over. It's now back to talking about very important issues, looking for solutions with bright, intellectually honest, hopefully, guests around this program each and every Sunday night. That is my pledge to you. Let's go to the left coast. Let's go to Spokane, Washington, where Mike is listening to us on KXLY. Go ahead.
Yeah, thanks, Bruce. I want to put a quick plug in for Notre Dame undefeated in Chicago Bears. Go Bears. As you know, the leadership of the Democratic Party, President Obama, have gone far left on social issues such as freedom of religion in America. Will this cause some ultimately in the Democratic Party or many to leave the Democratic Party, the base of the Democratic Party? Could it become a disastrous policy if far left is left in the long run?
I don't see, certainly you're the first one to bring that subject up. I don't think it's likely to happen, but I think it is interesting that, there was a pickup in the United States Senate by Democrats, but there are now three pro-life Democrats in the Senate Democratic Caucus. I don't think there's been three pro-life Democrats in the Senate for a long, long time. No. And the other historical thing that happened is there are now 20 women United States senators. So that is a remarkable, I think, move forward for women in politics.
What happened to that supposed Catholic backlash, which includes, of course, a lot of Hispanics, against the contraception issue? It didn't apparently materialize.
Didn't
so the caller may be right in the future, but certainly not this time.
Well, again, the Republicans were trying to make that Sebelius issue about religious freedom in the Catholic Church and ginning that up. And again, the Democrats, they were talking about it was a war on women, it was contraceptives, bring out Sandra Fluke, put her on the, make her a superstar at the convention. And it's the way in which each party was able to take the same decision. One knew what to do with it, the other didn't.
Well,
and the other had the support of the national news media.
One was more in tune with the way the country's headed. The country's becoming more diverse. The country's becoming more open-minded. You've talked about the ethnic changes. Mm-hmm. Young people tend to be more tolerant on race and sexuality.
Everything.
And it heartens me as a Democrat to see that most of the people at this table and certainly a lot of the Republican leadership just haven't figured that out yet. So
Are Catholics, if Catholics are that much revolt from their own church, why do they still go to the Catholic Church? I just find that interesting. If Catholics did not care a hoot about this contraceptive issue, why are they still Catholic?
Some did, and your point is you don't want to pay for it.
No, I don't want to pay for somebody else's. That's all.
All right, let's go to Eureka, California. The great state of California is joining us on KGOE. Go ahead.
Thanks for taking my call. Two really quick points. The first one, Marco Rubio was on the Jimbo Hannon Show. Hi, Jimbo.
Hi.
June 27th, and I asked him straight up if he was eligible to be VP or president, and he said he didn't know. You can listen to Jim's June 27th show. It's 28 minutes and 15 seconds in, and you decide. And to the gentleman that said how wonderful these illegal aliens had been to Chicago, you guys have been living off of writing hot checks on the American taxpayer all this time for their Medicare, their Section 8 housing, their schooling, all of that. How is that good for America? I do not get that at all. Thank you.
John.
Well, it's good to see the talk radio echo chamber is still functioning. I was afraid there were going to be some changes after last Tuesday.
It was just one caller. It was one caller at the end. What do you mean?
Do you think that they should come in the front door, though, when it comes to immigrants? Shouldn't they come through the front door instead of sneaking in the back?
I think there ought to be a border, and there ought to be rules.
Should we be able to control the border? We've been doing it for 100
absolutely.
Years.
And I think Bruce pointed out, thank you, Bruce, that that the president has strengthened the border, for which you all don't want to get
He may have strengthened it.
I think it's great.
But nonetheless, I mean, the reason that we're doing so many deportations is that we don't really control the border, and the building of a fence would go a long way.
You never asked me. I'm certainly in favor of what he is doing in terms of controlling the border between the U.S. and Mexico.
I just wish he didn't have to do as much of it.
And what we have to do now, and this is my segue in talking about some future programs we're going to do, one of the idiotic things that the government does at the federal level, which makes no sense in these tough economic times, when everything has to be, you know, in this era of sequestration and all that might be before us in the next 3 months in this country, we have to look at the issue of imprisonment, the way we deal with our prisons. I think the voters have spoken insofar as their view on pot smoking and also some of the polls. And so I think, you know, decriminalization of marijuana, looking at the prison populations, looking at mandatory minimums, looking at why when someone is picked up and arrested for violating the immigration laws, why are they put in federal prisons required to be fed, clothed, housed, and they have to take English lessons. English lessons are taught to prisoners, and when their term is up, guess what? They're sent back to Mexico after the United States taxpayer has paid for them for 3, 5, or 6 years. Now, does that make sense to you? In a country that needs money, does that make any sense at all? Going to be one of the things we're going to be talking about in the next several weeks on this program. On that note, we are out of time for this analytical show of 2012. Our Democrat has been John McCarron from DePaul University. Our Republican has been Mike Miller from DePaul University. Our talk show guest and our good friend Jim Bohannon from the Dial Global Radio Networks has joined us as well. This program is a Genevieve production produced in association with WLS Talk Radio in Chicago. Our thanks to Tom Veracruz and Dan Dorfman for their assistance in the production of this program. Until next Sunday night, this is Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.